On Reality Check this week, we have Shannon Souza, a Democrat running for state senator. We're open to conversation with anyone running for office, but this week, we've invited Shannon to tell us a little bit about why she's running and what's important about this election. So we have in the studio with me, I'm Lee Tooley, your host and co-producer. Pi White is our co-producer and our recording tech and editor, and Shannon Souza. Hi, Shannon.
Hello, Lee.
So I'm so glad you're here. I've been wanting to interview you for the longest time. You're running for state senator, and I like to start with the basics. Why? How does it work, the state senator? I mean, representatives, I know, come from each district. How does a senator work?
Very similar. We have 60 state representatives, and we have 30 senators.
Oh.
So if you just want to take gross numbers, and of course these are updated every time we have a census. The senators are representing about 120,000 people.
Okay.
Right now in this Senate district, which runs from about Charleston up to the north of us, all the way down to here, down to the California border, and over from the Pacific Ocean to I-5 corridor, we've got about 92,000 people in that Senate district now. So it's an interesting conversation to have with people who reside within the district, who can elect based on their vote, but also even outside of the district to have the conversations with people, because once you get to that legislative level, whether you're in the House or the Senate, you are one of either 60 or 30 votes. And in the case of the Senate, you're one of 30 votes.
Right, so it's going to be a collaborative process one way or another.
Absolutely.
Hopefully.
Yep.
And when you said I-5 corridor, so that's going to include like Medford and Ashland and all up the coast there,
that's
to Roseburg?
That's a great question. Roseburg is included. Medford, Ashland, and Grants Pass are not.
Huh.
It's a very, traditionally, it is a district that has been very red, if you will. Yep, rural red.
Rural red.
And that's how the lines were drawn.
And how are we doing now?
It is still rural red. Registered Republicans outnumber the registered Democrats. However, the non-affiliated voters, I remember you know this, of course, but others may not. Non-affiliated is different than independent.
Right.
Independent is its own party.
Yeah.
Non-affiliated voters grossly outnumber both of the major two parties. And I don't think that that is unique to this rural district. I think that this district is very exemplary of a lot of the rural districts that are scattered all around the United States. We are seeing and witnessing, and today I was out knocking on doors in Gold Beach and talking to people, and hearing firsthand that there's a growing dissatisfaction with a two-party system.
Oh, yeah.
And that I don't believe we will see the non-affiliated voters shrink. I believe that they will continue to grow.
So those voters, they're not necessarily non-voting. They're just not part of a particular party. They haven't sworn their allegiance, in other words.
You got it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And a lot of them do vote.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is quite a large section of those non-affiliated voters. In Oregon, as you may or may not know as listeners, whenever you go to the DMV to update your driver's license, you are automatically registered to vote. If you want to affiliate yourself with a party, one or the other, or the independent party is definitely on the scene and growing. So if you want to affiliate yourself with a party, that's a separate step that occurs after the fact.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of registered voters on the rolls that maybe have never voted before, and that's a very good point. It doesn't mean that non-affiliated voters don't vote, but we do have a lot of them, particularly in the 18 to 35 year old range, that have never voted. And as I'm encountering them walking around the district, I'm hearing that there is a conscious apathy. Mm-hmm. They are making the decision that they don't want to participate. They see it as some kind of an action against the two-party system and the political system. And that's really what any elected leader these days needs to overcome, is to bridge that gap and reconnect the people with democracy. Because without that voter participation, we're all dead in the water, whatever your political views are.
It seems to me I heard that we were 45% Democrat and 55% Republican. But in this recent, what was it called, the referendum, what was that proposal about medical stuff, that it actually the Dems took it 55 to 45. So it's a real question as to what those independent voters are voting for and how they're feeling about things.
Independents and non-affiliated.
Yeah.
And that's interesting.
I said independent. I meant non-affiliated.
Non-affiliated.
Yeah.
And that really gets to the crux of it, is when you start bringing up issues. So when we have referendums, we're talking about something very specific. And that's where the rubber meets the road. Mm-hmm. When you can talk to people about real issues.
Yeah.
Then the light starts to turn on, and there's this feeling, and rightfully so, that you can affect the environment that your society is living in.
Well, you know, it seems like so much of the news is focused on the national political scene, and people feel very disaffected from that in a lot of ways. But here on the local level, I mean, it has such a direct influence on how we live our lives, and people really can make such an impact.
Absolutely. I grew up in Puget Sound, which is, well, not in Puget Sound, on Puget Sound, on the shores in Washington State, just south of Seattle. And then I was educated for my university education in the Bay Area of California. And a lot of my friends, after we graduated, are living in San Francisco or Portland or Seattle. I moved here about 23 years ago and realized that there's this absolute gold mine of natural resource beauty and pioneer mindset and individualism and industrial capacity. I mean, people here know how to fix things, build things, do things, connect. It's amazing. And the other gold mine is, and I'm hoping that people realize it, that live here and in other rural communities, if you want to have a voice, you can.
Yeah.
If you live out in San Francisco or the bigger cities, man, you have to have a super, super loud voice and be really well connected if you want to get involved. If you live in rural America and you want to get involved, do it.
Yeah.
Don't sit on the, you know, don't be the armchair quarterback. Get up, suit up, and
yeah.
Do it. And you can, and it's wonderful.
Well, speaking of getting involved, tell us a little bit about your background and what has led you to wanting to be involved at such a deep level.
I'm going to throw you way back to my upbringing, because that's what I attribute it to. I come from parents who met in the Bay Area, in Santa Clara Valley, and both of their sets of parents met in World War II. And none of those four individuals that met in World War II came from any sort of affluence. Because of their service and the GI Bill, all of them came out as either registered nurses, they went to university, it completely transformed their lives and resulted in this situation where I was born into a family on the Puget Sound up in Washington, where my parents could say, hey, we're going to put you through school, you're going to be safe, you're going to have fun. All of your basic needs are going to be met, and any university you get into, we will pay for. Wow.
Yeah.
That's transformative.
And I wish we could do that today, but uh-uh.
No, we don't have that today, but we could have that today. That's leveling the playing field. Yeah. That is saying to any American, that is saying to anyone who is here and willing to push up their sleeves and study or work, that you do have access to the American dream. And that's really what has triggered me in all of my public involvement. I've never run for office before, but I've been involved in community service for all of my life. I was educated by Jesuits, and that's community service is part of the curriculum. It's what you do. So moving forward into my adult life and leading a family and business and engaging in the community, it's just a natural compulsion, and it's really, really satisfying. And when you start to connect with others in your community, you see, gosh, we have all these same people that are volunteering for all of these activities. Why are they doing it? It's satisfying. It makes you feel good. So when people ask you to step forward and offer your service, particularly in my case, I am 47 years old. I have a sister and a brother, and I have a dozen cousins. None of us have been called into active duty. None of us have served our country in the way that all of our grandparents did. So stepping up into public office, or the desire to serve and be elected into public office, is really fairly light duty when you compare it to what we send tens of thousands of our citizens all over the world to do and risk their lives every day.
Yeah, for sure. What are some of the issues that you're feeling really inspired by these days that make you want to run?
Inspired is hope. Mm-hmm. And I think that when Barack left office and asked us to step up, that was inspiring. What compels me is concern.
Yeah, better word.
I initially was running to invest in our resiliency. And resiliency, I'm a mechanical engineer by training. I have, through my profession, experienced public water supply, public education, energy systems, working environments, the timber industry, our watersheds, you know, all of these basic functioning factors that are necessary for a fully functioning society. And I see consistently that at the state level, we're not investing in rural.
Right.
We're really focusing our investment in where the votes are and where all the money is in the growing metropolis that is stretching from LA to Vancouver now, up the I-5 corridor, if we're talking about the West Coast. And that's really concerning to me. And it should be concerning to everyone, wherever they live, because our rural communities are what that's our agriculture. They define our country just as much as those metropolitan areas. Yet when you get to Salem or Olympia or Sacramento, the loudest voices are those that are the most populated.
Right.
And that are the most well-funded.
Sure.
Throughout my professional life, I have been traveling to Salem and Portland as an engineer, as a proponent for investment in rural infrastructure, specifically in Oregon. As I read the governor's mandated study on the impacts of a 9.0 seismic event, the Cascadia event, the rural communities that are all scattered up and down the coast, and saw that we would be without electricity for at least 18 months. And that's very modest.
Hello, Puerto Rico.
Yes, exactly. That really was quite compelling for
me. Very disturbing. My goodness.
Well, and it's compelling to know that we have the technology, we have the resources to do a lot better. Mm-hmm. And were we not a society that had, we haven't experienced that level of catastrophe Chile has, Japan has. They've experienced in the last 100 years 3 to 8 times in those 100 years that catastrophe. So there's this collective conscious living memory where grandpa remembers what that was like. So you have a cultural desire to invest in that resiliency planning, and we don't have that. We haven't been invaded lately, and we haven't had a Cascadia event. So when
it seems like it's very short-term thinking on the part of the politicians. It's how far do I need to go to get reelected again, and that's about it.
Absolutely. But as responsible leaders, understanding what our real exposure is to catastrophe, it not only behooves us to invest in our infrastructure, our resiliency planning, and that means both in terms of bolstering our electricity systems mm-hmm. with large-scale, meaningful electrical generation in our communities, which will all be isolated during a Cascadia event. It also means investing in our education systems so that we have children that are growing up that understand how to hunt and forage and grow and take care of themselves, and first aid, survival skills. If we can't take care of ourselves, how can we take care of each other?
Just a quick aside that we have a lot of rivers. That's one thing we're not short on. And I imagine that we could probably develop some hydroelectric along with renewables.
Absolutely. We have hydro, we have wind, we have solar. We have energy that is rolling through or flowing above or radiating down every single day. And we have battery technology that is here now and today. If we look at our critical facilities, that would be a hospital, water treatment plant, fire station, school sheltering facilities. They have 96 hours of fuel storage.
Wow.
That's it.
That's incredible. I know I think about these things sometimes when I get completely despairing. And I think, you know, everything depends on electricity. We don't even have gas power for the most part here. It's everything in this county is run on electricity.
So when we know that, and we are as these little civilized islands rolling along with full understanding that all of our basic, our commerce shuts down. Everyone uses a point of sale now, right? So if the power blips out, even if you still have gas that you can fry your burgers or you can, you know, pour a soda, you can't, your point of sale is down and commerce just shuts down.
And there's no way to fuel getting on the internet. All these things are just going to be gone if that should happen, if we lost our electricity.
And if we've lost our electricity and we haven't planned for it.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
And we haven't planned for it and we haven't invested in it. And as I started asking questions and talking to our emergency preparedness managers in the area, the picture became even more bleak to look at our communication systems. So getting back to your question, I'm sorry I digressed, but originally it was about that resiliency infrastructure and all of that, the societal, the education, mm-hmm. and the parts and pieces that would enable us, when isolated, to continue to function without external support. And those are all valuable even when there isn't a flood or a fire or a Cascadia event. That means that we have informed, capable, connected, engaged citizens. By the way, they're great for business. Who doesn't want those things? And we have a robust infrastructure.
What about food scarcity under those kind of circumstances? I think pretty much all of our food comes from out of the area. And if that's not happening, I mean, I've come down here before I moved here at Christmas time, and I couldn't go home because, you know, there's a landslide on 199 and it was flooded out at the Smith River, and, you know, there wasn't any way to leave town, let alone get anything in.
Absolutely.
So that's a whole other issue, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think that we can all take lessons from preppers. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to have, at my house, the rule was 6 weeks for six peeps, meaning you have food at the house for six people for 6 weeks. And we didn't have six people living at our house. But you know that there's a neighbor that didn't prepare, or someone walking through the neighborhood. If we can all get in that mindset as individuals, but even better, if we can get into that mindset as communities, so that we have community food shares, we are actively investing in our local food markets and food sourcing, then we're better off. Those are dollars that day to day, even without a landslide, we are not spending those dollars and sending them out of the county. We're keeping them right here and investing in ourselves. But what overshadowed all of that in my compulsion was that I was very intrigued to participate in a housing study that was put on initially up in Coos County. And today I was part of a focus group for the Curry County housing study that's underway. A big part of the housing study is looking at who are we, who lives here, what economic resources do we have, how much do we make, what's our mean income, and what can we afford to live in, and is that commensurate with the housing that we have available, or is it not, meaning I can afford $800 a month and the housing that's available is $1,600, or I can afford $500 a month and the housing is available at $1,200. And that's exactly where we're at. So as we're looking at these demographics, we're talking about poverty levels too. You start to kind of break down those different income levels and see what's happening. How many people do we have living at these different income levels, so we can figure out where we need to build the houses to house everyone. Rewinding a bit, 15 years ago, I was active with a group of moms. We were soliciting grant funds for a charter school up in Coos County. And we used the term, rightfully so, that we were the Appalachia of the West Coast. The poverty numbers were so high.
It was something like 48%.
Well, that was it wasn't as bad then.
Oh, okay.
No, you're fast forwarding to today.
Okay, well, let's go back.
Yeah, so we were looking at numbers that at the highest it was 25%. Now, keep in mind, on a national level, when community organizers and economic neighborhood revitalization professionals look at communities, when we get over 20% poverty, they don't really have a solution. We don't have a lot of success stories for turning this around. So 15 years ago, just to the north of Curry County in Coos County, and when we look at the economics of Coos and Curry and Douglas, they are scarily similar. We were calling that the Appalachia of the West Coast. We were looking at upwards of 25% poverty in some of our towns. The feds funded our grant and the school got up and going. So fast forward to last year, I'm sitting in a focus group with this housing study. I look at the maps. They had one map that was 15 years ago and one map that is now. And the poverty, the economic numbers, they kind of look like colored islands on the map to show you what the poverty numbers were for the different towns. They had doubled. It had spread. So what we're hearing about on a national level, we are seeing acutely right here. I had thought, hey, when my sons graduate from high school and move out, I would love to go down to Central America. It's third world nation. I want to help the girls and the women there to assert themselves and kind of reassociate themselves in a society that doesn't value them. And when I looked at those numbers and saw that in portions of Coos County, we had up to 48% poverty in our towns.
That's incredible.
This fear of a Cascadia event was just paled by the very clear and present danger of now, where we have this vast, vast and rapidly, scarily growing divide. We have a huge hole in the boat and it's getting bigger and bigger. We're taking on a lot of water. And it just really makes one feel that you want to push up your sleeves and see what you can do to help. Why is this happening? And how can we redirect it?
Well, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but affordable housing is a really big deal. But also, I think I heard that at the high school, less than half the kids were even getting a diploma. And, you know, a diploma doesn't even take you very far these days. So we have this huge population of folks raised here that are really at a disadvantage in terms of making a living wage.
Absolutely. It's grossly termed as generational poverty. Mm-hmm. And it's a cycle. And, you know, I'll defer back to the Obama campaign of the idea of hope and the thought of growing up in a home where there is no hope, where your parents or guardians or whoever is raising you don't have anything to look forward to. And by association, neither do you.
Yeah, it seems to be an intergenerational thing.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I know sometimes I feel like things are getting better because I'm in real estate and a lot of people come into town that are well-heeled to buy a nice oceanfront or a nice home somewhere else. But there's a whole lot of people that have lived here for ages and they just really don't seem to have much to sustain themselves. And, you know, if they're lucky, they go away to find a job and maybe find something, but there isn't much for them to do here to improve their situation.
Well, it's this chicken or the egg, okay? So we have on the coast, we have school projects not being built. We have houses not being built. We have medical appointments not being fulfilled. We have educational jobs not being fulfilled. We have jobs, but we don't have the people to fill them.
And because
we have
they're not
people
competitive
living
enough
in poverty. So what we really need to do is to realign our education system with today's economy. And in some cases, that's a simple streamline. That is the child that is well supported at home, that understands that there's a path forward and they can move forward and they can go, you know, our medicine and education, we have wonderful jobs there. Those both typically require some secondary education. Mm. What we're seeing increasingly though is, and you got at this with the only 50% diploma rates, you know, our we have some kind of bleak statistics out here on the coast for our kids to face, is there's nothing for that. They don't feel like they've got traction. We've really focused on that. Oh, secondary education, be an honor student. If you don't do that, then what is there for you?
Right.
We have building trades that are not being met. We don't have the workforce. I can't tell you. I'm a contractor. I work with the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, which, by the way, should be the International Siblinghood of Electrical Workers.
Yes.
I'll work on that next time. We don't have enough people to fill the jobs that we need to be done.
Oh, it's incredible. Again, because of my background, I'm often very involved with this trades. And, you know, all the old guys are getting to retirement age, and there's nobody taking their places. And it's, you know, one of the things that I see going on is people aren't building homes anymore for a variety of reasons. But one of the reasons is there aren't any journeyman craftsmen to build those homes.
And when we have major developers that want to roll in and develop big tracts of land, mm-hmm. Borax or anywhere else, immediately in their business plan, they're going to bring in an external construction company because they know that they can't find the workforce here.
Right.
Yet, we have people living in poverty.
Right.
So there are some really wonderful examples of great pathway, direct pathways into employment. that are occurring about the district. That's one of the really fun things about running for office. Anyone listening, if you're considering it, do it. Please do it. But you get to talk to lots of people and find out what's happening. Over in Roseburg, for example, they brought the employers to the school, not to the kids directly initially, found out what is it exactly that you need? What are these slots that you have to fill? How much do they pay? What do our students need? What are their skill sets that are required? And how far back up the chain? Can we start this in sixth grade? Can we start talking about this in fifth grade? Can we start talking to these kids who, you know, in some of our communities, up to half of them are living in households where they've never seen mom or dad work?
Oh, yeah.
So whether we want it like that or not, our public school system has to teach basic life skills of responsibility and personal hygiene and suiting up and showing up and ignite that fire of hope with something real at the end of it to say, oh, if you're interested in this and you want to continue working toward this or just investigate this throughout junior high school, you get to high school, bring the CTE programs back. Hardcore.
CTE.
When we're talking about technical experience in the classroom, we could have in the building trades, for example, we can have high school students building tiny houses. We have a housing crisis.
Oh, yeah.
They can do that.
So where are we now? I mean, I know back in the day, in the dark ages, when I was going to school, there was shop classes and things like that. When I had my foster child, this was be now... 5 to 10 years ago, there weren't any. But I heard recently that somebody was hired to teach carpentry. Where are we now in that process of getting those possible skills learned in school?
It depends on the school district.
How about here in Brookings, do you know?
I don't know about Brookings.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good question.
But in general?
But that is something that at the state level really should be an option for any high school student. Any of our public school students should have these options laid out for them. And if they're interested in going into any trade that does not require some other post-secondary education, then instead of, why don't we applaud that?
Yeah.
Why isn't that something that's celebrated? And in the meantime, while they're working toward that graduation diploma, they can be making meaningful contributions to our communities that result in a resume that says, yes, I've been there, I've built that, I've done that, but more importantly, in their own human developmental process, they have experienced what it is to take care of themselves and participate in the community and help to make their community a better place.
Yeah, so are you seeing this in terms of creating apprenticeship programs after high school? How does it work in your vision?
Well, it depends on that. So we've been talking to both the union and non-union apprentice programs in the building trades. And depending on which of those trades there are, they have different lines that you can or can't cross before you get into their apprenticeship programs. So it really is an interactive conversation that is definitely opening up. We have a shortage statewide, region-wide, as we're all investing in our infrastructure. So people are at the table, they're ready to talk. Instead of sitting back and saying, oh, well, you know, back 20 years ago when we tried to talk to the union about their apprenticeship program, they said, no, we're not gonna change it. That's not the case.
Oh, good.
We have people are ready to talk. And I think that that's really paramount and of utmost importance, particularly today with what we see in the national political rhetoric, which is insanely polarizing. And based on my conversations with real people living in our neighborhoods, completely inaccurate. If people can see a common good and something that they want to work together toward, they will.
So you're saying that polarization that seems so strong in the way that it's represented in the media is not necessarily true on a grassroots level around here anyhow.
Correct. And I think that in rural America, we understand that if your chicken's not laying eggs and you need to make a cake, you go next door and knock on the door. And it doesn't matter how they vote or what church they go to or what have you. When you're in rural America, that is susceptible to every natural disaster known to the earth except for locusts, which is what the Oregon coast is.
Yeah.
We get them all. We have this amazing capacity of strength in that we're so frequently experiencing these minor or major catastrophes, we know what it takes to survive. Mm-hmm. And there is no time for bickering or consideration of what our differences are. We can see what the common goal is and figure out who has the tool, who has the skill, and cut the tree out of the road and clear it so we can get grandma to the hospital.
Exactly. Well, downshifting to another subject that it's real important to me, and I assume for you too, is affordable housing. What's going on in that area right now as we stand here, and what's your vision?
Well, what we're seeing in affordable housing is a conversation that is occurring, and that's wonderful. These housing studies that have been issued, they've brought the players to the table. The players are those that are representing the homeless, mm-hmm. those that are representing the working class, the employers that can't get the employees here that they need. And then you start to break the ice and really figure out what are those barriers. Today I was in Port Orford talking to the group about that housing focus study and what are the issues in Port Orford, what are the issues in Gold Beach, what are the issues in Brookings, up and down the coast. We all have housing shortages at all levels. But when we start to say, hey, what would happen if we allowed these ancillary structures, a second structure on a home? Do we have the capacity in our water supply systems, in our sewer systems to accommodate that? If we don't, then can we develop that? If we do have that capacity, then is there an outdated ordinance that should be reviewed? Can we change this? So it's really going to be that the housing shortage is so vast and hitting at every single economic level that there is not one solution. We really do have to look under every rock. So some of those are looking at how our cities are zoned. Do we not want to expand our urban growth boundaries? And if we don't, then how can we support those who would like to increase the density with the ancillary building structures, with allowing RVs to be parked and lived in? When we look at what our minimum wage is, someone working full time at minimum wage can afford an $80,000 house.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any of those on the market?
Except for mobile homes and parks. It doesn't exist.
There you go. So we're talking about mobile homes. We're talking about tiny homes. We're talking about in Ashland, they've got a project where they're taking old Bluebird buses and insulating them and putting in fireplaces. And it's really, really about the community coming together and figuring out what resources do we have and how can we make this work for everyone. Another one that is a bit controversial is looking at private and public collaboration in land trusts. If you have employers in the area that need to open up more housing, we want more housing, whether it's the service industry for tourism or education or medicine or manufacturing, whatever it is, and we have... we've got land sitting on the county rolls or a city, but they don't have the financial fortitude to develop it. Can we establish partnerships that are private, where that capital financial fortitude is coming from, and public, where the land is sitting there. Very valid concerns. My understanding is that when they did this in LA years ago, they set up these land trusts for affordable housing, but they timed out, whatever it was, 25 years, 50 years. And when they timed out, the housing became no longer affordable and skyrocketed. Right. But that doesn't mean that we have to write our agreements like that now.
No.
We can look at that and understand what that concern is and address it. So
you're saying the employers that needs help would be the private funder
sometimes,
in partnership.
Sometimes it is the employer directly has that capital. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe in medicine or mega golf resort, something like that. But oftentimes the employer is establishing the need. There's right. the demand and there's not enough supply, but they're not in the business of developing housing. That's yeah. where the housing developer comes in, but doesn't have access to the land. That's where the public comes in and says, hey, we've got some land, but we want to make sure, yes, developer, you're going to make your money. Got that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in this game.
Right.
You don't want to participate otherwise. But we're going to ensure that it remains in that workforce availability structure.
So the land would actually be publicly held lands.
Yes.
I gotcha. Okay. So what other issues are on your mind these days that, you know, would be top of mind were you to be successful?
Public communications are top of mind. Public media. We have, this is a great example.
KCIW.
And up north, I drive around, JPR is broadcasting. It's of paramount importance that the public, whether it's radio or television, in any of our communications, that we have secure access to reliable communications. The outright capitalization and commercialization of our communication systems is not just scary, it's terrifying.
So the unification, monopolization of media on the more national scale, that's the concern there, that don't have the independence?
That we don't have the independence, but then on a local and a state, when we have communities that we're running broadband through, we need to, as a state and as communities, establish that the public retain consistent access to communications through whatever communication systems are running through our communities.
So that feels under threat at this point.
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely. And it's one of those sleepers that I don't think.
Well, I know there was just that big judgment about open access to the internet and all of that, net neutrality.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it, I guess.
Definitely. That's a huge part of it. You know, we have come to the point where we rely so heavily on whatever it is that you like to do. Do you Snapchat? Do you Messenger? Well, we don't have control over what flows through those systems, and I understand that's a capitalist system. They can decide what they want to allow to flow through those vehicles, but we need to make sure that there are independent, publicly held, secure communication systems.
Gotcha.
For us.
Yeah.
Whether they're popular or not, when we don't have the choice, if in the future those privately held entities decide either discreetly or overtly to determine what can and cannot be communicated, we better have publicly sanctioned, secured methods of communicating. We have got to be able to communicate and engage with one another without private intervention.
Makes sense to me. One of the things that's so scary now is that all these things are becoming so unified into just a few tracks, media-wise, on the more national level, and everything is so polarized. I mean, ever since we got these cable news stations, things have been going in that direction, and it gets to where nobody listens to anybody else. And that's certainly one of my concerns, is how do we increase dialogue?
Absolutely. Increase dialogue and civility. I would love to see, talk about vision. We have wonderful nonprofit groups and organizations active in our communities that have amazing programs. And when you were talking about our interactions with one another, it makes me think of League of Women Voters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, wow, what if we could integrate the League of Women Voters system, program, into our public education system? What if all sixth graders, for example, were pages?
Yeah, why
and,
not?
And what if all seventh graders met all of our candidates? What if we had a wonderful, we started something called Drinking Civilly at a brew pub in our community to get unlike-minded people together to talk about political topics with local impacts. And it's just 2 hours once a month. It happens at a pub. You don't have to be a beer drinker. There's lemonade there, whatever. But the second to the last one that we held was on civil discourse. And the League of Women Voters sponsored an essay contest for our junior high and high school students on civil discourse. That was the most inspirational 30 minutes I can remember. You know, maybe since Obama's inauguration, honestly. It was to hear these three finalists, these kids, explain to a room full of adults how to discuss topics and remain civil is a wonderful thing, and it does fill you with hope. So why don't we integrate that into our public school system?
Used to be we all had to take civics, and I don't think they do that anymore.
Boy, we need it.
We really
now
need it.
Now more than ever.
Yeah. And exactly. How old were those kids, by the way?
Well, it was funny. I think that the essay contest was supposed to start at 15, but one of the finalists, he was 11. He was a homeschool student. And
oh, really?
He, wow, he blew our socks off.
Hmm.
Yeah, so eloquent. So eloquent. Really wonderful. And I think getting back to the other hot topics for me, the other big one is childcare.
Oh, yeah.
And that hits everybody. Finding and support. Our society doesn't support childcare. It's minimum wage or less than minimum wage is what is paid to people that are taking care of our kids. Interestingly enough, up at Advanced Health at Bay Area Hospital, they were toying with the idea of offering childcare to their medical staff, mm-hmm. because it's an issue. It's,
sure
it's
it is,
difficult
yeah.
to staff, and nobody can find childcare. So they thought, okay, we'll have a top of the line childcare facility here. So now we have numbers. We know that it's about $11.40 an hour for an infant. And it was like eight something an hour for a toddler up to a certain age. Those are high numbers. If you are going to work, you can't afford that.
Not at minimum wage, you can't.
But it's I think that it is a really good example of how far out of alignment our society has gotten, that we can't afford to work and pay for the childcare that is necessary for our children. And we've got to invest in that. You look at investments in Head Start, for example, a dollar spent in Head Start saves you $27 down the road in support services or the penal system, if you will.
Right.
So we know it's true, and we can look at other societies and Northern European societies that do invest heavily in their child care for all of their citizens. And guess what? It's really good for the economy. The difficulty is taking that step, because you've got to find the funds that we're spending right now. Nobody wants new taxes. Nobody wants to find more money. So we've got to find ways to take funds that we're expending right now and just can start to ratchet them and redirect them toward the earliest childhood experience when we can take care of our kids. This is such a travesty. Do you know what the number one indicator of poverty is? Like the best, if you look statistically at anything, your gender, your race, your religion, or anything, what's the one factor that will best determine if you're poor?
You mean, well, I guess I would assume it was education, but I don't know.
Motherhood.
If you're a mother, then you're going to be poor.
You're way more likely to live in poverty.
So interesting.
So that's
so sad.
That child care piece is
makes all the difference.
Yeah. And if you want to put it in real, just business sense, that's the best return on investment for society.
Yeah.
It helps the mothers take care of themselves, get back to work, take care of their families, and live with confidence knowing that their children are being well cared for. And it helps our society knowing these children are being well cared for.
Yeah.
They're going to know how to suit up and show up and participate and take care of themselves and help take care of others as they grow up.
So one other thing that I had a question about I want to catch before we have to close. What about opioids in this area? Is that I keep hearing about New England and Ohio and places that are having a terrible problem, but aren't we having a problem too?
We're having a terrible problem also. We were right at the top of the list.
Is that right? Because I don't hear much about that around here.
Well, and we just, that at Drinking Civilly, that was actually the last topic that we had.
Oh, is that right?
The opioids epidemic. And it's interesting because changes have been put into place. And we're waiting to see if those start to help.
Like what
and
kind of changes?
Those kinds of changes are dramatic restrictions on the number of opioid prescriptions that are given.
How do you do that? You give a doctor a quota or something?
Ah, you got it. The other thing that was occurring were that we had kind of these blanket subscriptions, and my number is not going to be correct, but let's say typically you prescribe this opioid and it's for 30. And that's what you give every patient that's leaving the hospital or whatever, instead of saying, you know, what's your tolerance for pain? Do you ever, like, when I had my surgery, I was able to say to my doctor, you know, I don't use painkillers much. So he gave me like 4, just in case I really needed them, instead of 30 that are then sitting on the shelf. But the bigger push and the more effective change is integrating mental health into all of our community services. Why are people abusing? In some cases, it's accidentally. They had a surgery, they had an injury, they never were a user in the past. Some of these opioids are ridiculously addictive. And that's one train, and that's what you address at the physician level.
Right.
Let's get better about what we're prescribing to who. But in terms of abuse, who's stealing these, who's buying them off the black market, we have serious mental health issues. And when we start to address those at school, during your standard checkup, your exams, that's the integration piece is saying to someone, you don't have to make a special appointment with a therapist or decide that you need help. We're just gonna deliver that integrated mental health into your regular day-to-day process and just check in on one another. That's another great return on investment. And it's a huge societal experiment that we are going through right now and that we're just starting to see the benefits of.
So you're saying also that an MD doing the annual exam would also have a checklist of what he's checking out in terms of emotional and mental stability.
Well, you know, in the case of your annual exam, like, hey, how you doing, blah, 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 oh, I got divorced, da, 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 so you go through your checkup, says, okay, you know how the nurse comes in and takes your blood pressure? Now, as a regular part of that, the psychologist comes in to that same exam with the same billing structure and just checks in on you. So how was that divorce? How are the kids? Is everything okay? Just these preventative checkups, and if there is an identified need for additional support, then immediately it's followed up on, just as you would have a checkup if you had an irregular pap. You know,
like,
okay, well, we have you down for another appointment in 6 weeks with this therapist, and we've put out the word to the pediatrician, so your kids are going to go. So there's a stigma in our culture about seeking help and mental health.
Yes.
And it's it affects all of our society and all of our lives.
Well, I suspect that so much of the opioid problem and alcoholism is just self-medicating because people are having those issues.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, we got to start wrapping this up. Anything that we haven't hit on that you really wanted to say in closure? I don't want to leave anything out.
I have been spending I have spent the last 4 months really driving around the district because I'm interested in serving it and getting to know the various communities. And I am just so blown away and heartened by the beauty of the land and the beauty of the people. It might sound as some kind of a sales pitch, but it's true. We live in the most beautiful place on earth.
We do.
And we have the most pioneering, frontiering, independent people here. I know that we have everything that we need to take care of ourselves.
I believe that. And I'm so glad you came to share with us. I hope you can come back again. We're having the election in November, is that right?
Yep, November 6th is the date.
And anybody who wants to get registered, do you know when they have to be registered by?
That's a good question, I should know.
Okay, well, I'm sure that it's available to get registered, even online these days, I think.
Oh, Secretary of State, SOS, Oregon, is very easy. It takes about 30 seconds to update your registration. If you have a driver's license, you're already registered. You will find yourself there. And if you're not, it's equally easy to register to vote.
That's great. Well, thank you so much again for coming and sharing your vision with us. And I wish you all the best. This has been Shannon Souza and myself, Lee Tooley, and KCIW on Reality Check. Thank you so much for listening. Here at KCIW, we don't endorse candidates or take any particular political positions, so we invite all candidates and parties to come on and share their views.